Thank you. Council, remember where they are in the argument. So when it's time for you to begin, you will see a green sign like this that says start. When you have 5 minutes to go, you're going to see a yellow sign like this. And when your argument is over, you're going to see a red sign like this. So even if you don't take a minute to read the words, which are printed quite large, the color will help you know. I will help you as well, although I'll always let you finish answering a justice's question if your red sign goes up. If you are continuing on to make further arguments beyond that, I will remind you that your time has concluded. So with those small matters taken care of, I'm going to call our second case of the day, State versus Gendusa. And Attorney Comfort, are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Lisa Comfort, and I am on behalf of the petitioner of the State of Wisconsin. Your Honors, we have a lot of issues here, but the bottom line is that the Circuit Court had no lawful authority to order the private mental health information of 1,400 people who have no connection to this case turned over as discovery in Gendusa's commitment proceeding. And the reason for that is it's protected by law and it meets no part of the 980 discovery statutes. And every single issue in this case can be resolved by that fact.
Will you start, counsel, with please telling us there's a really big disparity between the facts as you allege them with respect to Directive 36 and the facts as alleged by defense. Was DOC planning on turning this over? That's what the defense counsel, that's what you seem to be saying, and the defense counsel just didn't follow up, and they're saying they were, kind of sounds like a little bit of gamesmanship on behalf of the department. So if they can get this by Directive 36, doesn't that kind of handle the whole matter?
Yes, Your Honor, it does handle the whole matter. And that's part of the problem here is Gendusa has just gone about this the wrong way. There is a way to challenge agency decisions that you think injure your substantial rights, and that's through Chapter 227. We don't really even know why he doesn't have this yet, because he went about this by taking his request back to the Circuit Court. And I think if you actually look at the record, his allegations that DOC just decided to keep this from him, I don't think are supported by that record. If you look at, in particular, record number 47, the transcript from that proceeding, it becomes very clear that once Attorney Weitz found out that the Research Review Committee went to Dr. Tyer to ask him what of this information was responsive to their research request, it seems like he kind of interpreted that as some kind of statewide conspiracy to keep it out of his hands. And from that point on, he simply pursued this through the 980 proceeding.
You know, counsel, just to follow up on that, I'm not understanding why it's relevant. I mean, there's a separate DOC inquiry here in getting the evidence, but this is the questions before us relate to discovery. So whether he can get that information or hasn't gotten it through alternative means, I'm not understanding how that affects our analysis from the discovery standpoint.
It doesn't, Your Honor. And that's the state's argument, is that there's a very specific statute that goes to discovery in Chapter 980 cases, and it's not been untouched by the legislature. They have amended this statute. They specifically amended it to remove the broad, wide-open discovery standard from the civil standard. And if you look at 980.11, it says very specifically that Chapter 804 no longer applies to Chapter 980 proceedings, and that 980.036 is the only means of getting discovery in Chapter 980. And I think it's important to also take a look at 980.0314, because that statute says very specifically what a party's retained expert like Dr. Thornton is entitled to access to perform an evaluation. And it says that such an expert is supposed to have reasonable access to the person or the person's records or the person's history. So a retained expert is allowed to have reasonable access to information about the person in this proceeding. There's absolutely nothing that entitles an expert to access other people's private health information who have no connection to this case to conduct a new research project as discovery. And I think it's instructive that Gendusa never really was able to hone in on any particular section that showed that he was actually entitled to this. It was a very scattershot argument. He changed what he was asking for several times over the course of these hearings. But I think the biggest part is this trial court got it absolutely correct during this first hearing. And I believe this is on record page 44, page 41. The trial court specifically acknowledges at that June 26 hearing and tells Weitz, you're speculating that this information is exculpatory. It may be, it may not be, you're speculating though. So because we can't say that this information is exculpatory just because in California it happened to be. And that was correct, and that should have ended this inquiry. None of the rest of these hearings even should have taken place.
And so let's, but that isn't where it ended. So let's, I mean, there was obviously ongoing proceedings and the trial court heard some testimony and changed its mind here. Let's put aside the privacy issues and HIPAA and state law for just a moment and focus on the statute. And some five here of 980.036, I'd just like you to address that. When I read it, on a motion of a party, the court may order the production of any item of evidence or raw data that is intended to be introduced at the trial for testing or analysis under such terms and conditions as the court prescribes. He says, yeah, this information looks to me to be helpful to my case. It's raw data. I'm asking for it. So I can present the information at trial to show why it shows the result may have been different. It's helpful to my case. The trial court orders it. The trial court actually puts an order. This is not under the section dealing with mandatory disclosures. It looks like it's a discretionary, determination of a judge that we would normally accord some measure of deference to. Why doesn't that entitle him? If this is, again, maybe the trial court shouldn't have done that. Maybe trial court's judgment was wrong, but it came out the other way. And normally speaking, we don't overturn reasonable judgments. Why doesn't that provide the legal authority for him to get access to the data?
Because I think if you look at the statute as a whole in conjunction with some of these other statutes, Justice Hagedorn, it makes it very clear that 980.0365 is not just a blanket invitation that you can get whatever you want just by prospectively stating, oh, hey, I think I would like to introduce that at trial. If you put some, this has to be read reasonably, and the only reasonable reading of this is that it has to be something that something that was intended to be introduced at trial was based on before you can get this information that way. And I know you say accepting the privacy statutes, but we don't read these statutes in isolation. We have to read them in conjunction with everything else. And if you go to Chapter 51 and Chapter 146, there are two specific statutes in both of those sections that say what patient healthcare records can be disclosed for use in a Chapter 980 proceeding. And those are with Stat 5130, subsection 4B8S, and Section 146.822.22cm. And counsel, those both say that records can only be released for the purposes of a 980 proceeding if the treatment records involve or relate to an individual who is the subject of the proceeding or evaluation. And as Dr. Tyer testified, Mr. Gendusa, his data is not any part of this set. His information's not part of this set. It wasn't considered in any way in making any kind of evaluation of him. It wasn't considered in any way in making any kind of evaluation of anybody else. So
do you dispute that if he wanted the raw data for the static 99, that he couldn't have the raw data for the static 99?
You mean the data that the current samples are based upon?
Right, because you're using it. You're using the state is using a test based on information gathered from individuals who have rights and privacy rights, and perhaps it would be redacted some way. But do you dispute, because the state's using the static 99, that he couldn't get his hands on the raw data if the state had it in its possession and he didn't? I mean, I'm making a couple leaps here, but do you dispute that?
I mean, so I think That's a more difficult question because a lot of these things have been determined to be proprietary. And so
I'm getting you past that because I'm trying to hone you in on a point. So what the issue I'm having with this is that the state has in its possession the DOC data that could give information about individuals in the state of Wisconsin. And much like the static 99 data, that then forms the basis of a recidivism argument. The state here is introducing an argument that is saying Mr. Gendusa is more likely than not to reoffend in a sexually violent manner because these individuals in this study with this score were more likely than not. So what the argument here is about Wisconsin data. And what you're saying is he has no way of getting that data, that the state could get the data, they could make an argument, or they could keep it from him. They could realize that it's less and they could just keep it from him, even though the state is relying on a recidivism argument much the same way. And so that's the part, when you talk about exculpatory evidence, isn't that the crux of it? Is that this is potentially an argument that's exculpatory to the recidivism argument that is being made by the state?
You know what, I can just interject briefly because Justice Dallet just kind of touched upon the two things I want to make sure you talk about, and it's part of her answer. One is this in the state's possession? And two, how does Brady interact with discovery in this kind of case?
Okay. So I think that there were a lot of premises there in your question, Justice Dallet, that need to be addressed in order to actually answer that question. I think the kind of data that you're talking about that the Stat 99 is based on, that's definitely, I think that's something that this kind of statute would get to, but I think what this statute's really getting to is if you have an independent evaluation by somebody, and let's say they give you the, one of the other tests, some kind of psychological evaluation, and the party wants to introduce that evaluation at trial, then the other party is entitled to discover the raw data, the information that came out of that evaluation, so that they know if the person's been, if the evaluation, the data was applied in that evaluation correctly, and they can challenge it and things like that. I think if the state actually had, and I will get to your question, Justice Ziegler, about whether the state has this in its possession. I just want to address this real very quickly. If the state had all of the static 99 background information and it was planning on introducing the static 99, I think that's possibly something that could fall under this statute. However, this doesn't give somebody a license to just go on a fishing expedition to find something to create new evidence just because it might exist out there in the world and is held by somebody who is governed, an entity that's governed by the state of Wisconsin. And so to get to your question, Justice Ziegler, I think I inartfully articulated what I meant when I said this isn't in the state's possession. I do think that the statute's very clear that DOC really just has notice requirements and it's DHS that does the bulk of the investigation here. But even assuming that DOC's process for winnowing out who is getting recommended for a special purpose evaluation and who is not, assuming that's enough of an investigation to put them more akin to the law enforcement in some kind of way, just because something is technically in the custody of a state entity doesn't necessarily mean that it's in the state's possession as the statute would, to be covered by the statute. And we see that all the time in other kinds of, particularly criminal proceedings. No one would dispute that law enforcement is considered part of the state in a criminal proceeding. But that doesn't mean that a defendant can just walk in and have blanket access to every piece of evidence in every single investigation that the police department in any jurisdiction has ever undertaken. They can't go in and, for example, say, I want to pull all the police personnel files because they're in the state's possession and I think I might be able to find something exculpatory in there. So give them to me because they're in the possession of the state. And that's really akin to what he's doing here.
So it sounds like your argument is going to the exculpatory nature. That's not, they're all still in the state's possession, right? You're not, well, I mean, you're really arguing these aren't the state's. It sounds like your argument is geared towards sub J, which is so, what's exculpatory and what's not.
I mean, that's a big facet of our argument here, and it's because that's what they focused on in the circuit court is, I mean, you know, we have a lot of case law about what exculpatory is, evidence is and what exculpatory evidence isn't. And that's all very, it's all pretty clear that if it's something that just has to be further evaluated and subject to tests before it can have any kind of intrinsic value, that's not exculpatory. And, you know, a lot of those are criminal cases because that tends to be where the exculpatory evidence analysis comes up. But I don't think that means that they're not instructive, particularly considering that the legislature here made a conscious decision to change this discovery statute and make it much more akin to the criminal discovery statute than the wide open kind of civil discovery that we have in civil cases.
So can we go? Go ahead, Justice Agron.
Sorry, I'm just going to have one quick follow-up and related to my last question. It seems like, you know, sub five here, putting aside the issues under sub two, H and J, that you actually have a trial court making a finding here. You have a trial court making a finding that this is going to be helpful to his case, to Jin Duce's case. So I guess I start with that proposition here. And it seems like the concern is that by saying this order is legally acceptable, putting aside again the privacy statutes, let's look at the discovery issues for just a minute, that it opens up some big door. But you're right, this really has been shut down, that where there used to be much more wide-ranging discovery. This used to be governed by normal civil discovery rules. But sub five seems to offer a very narrow window to defendants. And that is, if you can persuade a trial court judge that this information that is an item of evidence or it's raw data intended to be introduced at trial, that, you know, that the trial court deems it helpful. Why doesn't that apply here? And sub H, by the way, talks about the raw data underlying the state's test. So that has to be turned over anyway for the state's expert. So it almost seems that the raw data language in sub five has to be referring to something else other than what the state's expert relied on. Why isn't it this situation exactly?
I think it is referring to something else than what the state's expert relied upon, Justice Hagedorn. Well, so here's what I think the big difference is there. If you look at the provisions that allow a circuit court to appoint an expert under 980 for evaluation, or there are a lot of parts of the statute that allow the defense to find their own expert and do their own evaluation and things like that. So I think that is where this, that's where we're not talking about H. H is about what the prosecution and the things it intends to introduce into trial. That's subsection two is all about what the prosecution has to give to the defense. I think this statute was more intended to go towards the aim of that court-appointed expert who may not have, you know, it might not be for either party. It's the court-appointed expert who, you know, is doing this independent evaluation. I think.
But it doesn't say that, counsel. Huh? I mean, it doesn't say that.
But I think when you read the rest of the statutes in context, that's really what this gets to. And I think that's why the point that the other party and or the part that the evidence had to be intended to be introduced into trial, I really think that's what that was going for. Because if you just read that as, okay, this allows the circuit court to give anybody anything that they prospectively, without having it in their possession or ever seeing, say, I would like to introduce that into trial, I don't think that's a reasonable reading of the statute. And the reason for that is that puts absolutely no limit on discovery whatsoever. I mean, you know, anybody could just walk into any state agency and say, hey, I think you guys might have some information that might be helpful to me. I want to discover it. And
not unless the circuit court orders it. I mean, that's a pretty big, that's unlike normal civil discovery where you have entitlement to all kinds of stuff. Here, the door is closed unless the circuit court opens it. I mean, it seems like this was the legislature's effort to provide an opportunity here where you have someone who's saying, listen, you have data that will show that my case might turn out differently. And it looks like it will. The trial court looks at it, examines the experts and says, Yeah, I agree. So turn it over. It seems that that's a pretty narrow rule that doesn't open the door to much as a broader matter.
I mean, I would disagree, Justice Hagedorn. I mean, I think that interpretation of that statute is just too wide open. I think the only way that you could possibly say, hey, this is something I intend to introduce at trial, which, by the way, to be clear, Gendusa never purported to that he wanted to introduce this at trial. In fact, he, contrary to what he says in his brief, he told the circuit court very clearly that this was only going to be disclosed to a couple of people, and this data was never meant to be introduced at trial. So what we see here is Gendusa moving the goalposts a lot. Every single time one of his arguments got refuted, he changed what he was asking for, and then he changed what his theory was for why he would do it. And I think we ended up in the circuit court really with a lot of hearings about the nature of what this might show and where it was going that really had absolutely no relevance to the statute. And I know, Justice Hagedorn, that you've said setting aside the privacy issues, but these are all intertwined and you can't set aside the privacy issues. I mean, these privacy statutes were put in place specifically to address this kind of thing. And they have very specific provisions about what kind of data can and information about people can be released as part of a 980 proceeding. And it's very clear that the statutes say the information about the subject of the proceeding, like that is what is allowable to be disclosed. Otherwise, someone has no right to discovery of other people's private health information.
Counsel, I have a question, but I understand Justice Kurofsky, you have a question also. You were starting.
Yeah, Justice Hagedorn asked 90%, excuse me, of my question. So thank you, Justice Hagedorn. And go ahead, Justice Bradley.
I have a threshold question. I wonder what we're doing here. I think that since the inception of the Court of Appeals in the mid-1970s. Now, I don't know this for sure because I haven't researched since the mid-1970s, but I think it's certainly true in the 25 years that I've been here. We have never taken a review of a denial of an interlocutory appeal request unless the party is asking us to invoke our superintending and administrative authority to impose a category of cases where the Court of Appeals have to take the case in interlocutory nature. You cite on page 14 of your reply brief, the Jenich case, that was superintending and administrative authority being invoked for all cases regarding double jeopardy. Well, we denied that. There was another time when denial of a Court of Appeals interlocutory appeal was brought to us with regard to a qualified immunity. That's the only one that I remember that we granted, because qualified immunity means immunity from suit. And so we said, okay, all qualified immunity interlocutory appeals shall be granted. So what are we doing here? Couple of times in past opinions, I've put, once the camel's nose is in the tent, the rest is sure to follow. I think it would be horrible precedent for us to start reviewing denials of interlocutory appeals absent the invocation of superintending authority. Can you respond to that?
Certainly, Justice Bradley. I admit that it's rare, and I admit that this court usually doesn't do it. But
okay, just a minute. There's a difference between being rare. Point to me any case, because the only one you cited was superintending authorities are being invoked. Point to me any case where we have done this.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have the details of the case right in front of me at the moment, but I believe it was, I think you authored Levitt versus Beverly Enterprises, where it said that your refusal to do this is more a matter of practice and not a lack of authority to do so.
Sir, and we've said that in many cases, and I smile because we have said it so often that it's a matter of practice, not a matter of law, but that sure establishes a lot of legal precedent. We don't do this. So
yeah,
I'm certain that absent the invocation of administrative or superintending authority, we are now getting into a whole new ball game that is not institutionally good for us to engage in. Respond.
Well, Your Honor, this court has typically been willing to find remedies to afford a party who has no avenue of legal redress. I believe you just did that in Warren versus Meisner as well. And this is a situation where the state just simply had no options. I mean, you know, I don't think there's really any dispute between the parties that the Court of Appeals didn't properly exercise its discretion in denying my petition for leave. I think it was pretty clear that this met at least one of the criteria. And so, you know, we should have been in the Court of Appeals. I don't disagree with you there. But when they refused to review it, and that's reviewed for an erroneous exercise of discretion, the state only had a few options. I mean, I could have pursued, there are probably some other avenues I could have pursued, but I thought that with the wide open questions of law and the fact that they haven't been answered by any court in this state, I thought a petition for review was probably the most appropriate avenue to pursue this. I think the fact that this court ordered us to address the merits of all these questions shows just how important this issue actually is. And while it's true that this court doesn't step in and, you know, adjudicate a whole lot of discovery disputes, I think in this particular situation, I think it's important that it do so. I mean, there have been several times when this court has done something similar. And yes, most of the time it is for a category of cases. But here, I think there's an important principle that needs to be established here about just how much privacy do people actually have in their private medical information that is afforded by these statutes? Can you get it around it by discovery? Or do we really mean that we're going to be protecting people's private health information? And I think that's a weighty enough issue that this case really warranted this court's review once the Court of Appeals denied the state's petition for leave to appeal this order. Am I done? Sorry.
Yeah, your time is up, but you can chat with us a little bit more in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Council Haskell, are you ready to go?
Yes, thank you.
Please do.
So importantly, the data that we've been discussing here in the Department of Corrections possession and in the state's possession, you know, really reflects a routine overestimation of risk in these types of Chapter 980 prosecutions. And this is really the most reliable set of data that exists to determine whether Gendusa or those facing Chapter 980 prosecution do satisfy the criteria for commitment. Dr. Thornton at the evidentiary hearing testified that we want to compare Gendusa to similarly situated offenders, that we're really looking to have those who face similar treatment options, similar confinement conditions, similar release conditions, to get really the best apples to apples comparison. Are these people likely to reoffend? And the DOC data set here is really the most reliable and the most similar sample that we have in the world. These are offenders who have been referred for a special purpose evaluation, just like Gendusa has. And instead, the state here is asking the fact finder in the 980 case eventually to rely predominantly on international offenders entirely from Canada and Denmark, which is the comparative sample that the state's expert has used.
Attorney Haskell, I understand that part of your argument, and I understand why, for reliability reasons, you would want to compare Mr. Gendusa to a pool, if you will, of people similarly situated people in Wisconsin. Can you talk, though, about the protected health information? Because it seems that the state is very, very concerned about that. How do we balance protecting people's health information against Mr. Gendusa's, as you say, as your argument is, right to have this information?
Sure. I mean, first and foremost, I want to focus on what was discussed in our brief, that we have no interest in obtaining any of the health information that is included in this data set. Again, this data set does not have descriptive information about individuals or any sort of, you know, narrative summaries or anything like that. You know, available in the record is a copy of this spreadsheet. I mean, it's a lot of ones and zeros, just sort of a coding of what information was taken from the SPE. And so first, again, we don't want the data. We are perfectly happy to stipulate to remand for the entry of an amended order. And in this case, I think the circuit court entered an order for disclosure of the entire database after having seen Dr. Tyer testify incredibly over and over again about his reasons for not disclosing the data and the court being concerned that this Directive 36 process wasn't going anywhere. And so, you know, again, first and foremost, we don't want anything that may indicate a mental health diagnosis, a substance abuse diagnosis. Secondarily is the fact that we've already been approved under HIPAA, under Directive 36, to actually have that data disclosed to the defense. There would be no HIPAA violation in sustaining the circuit court's discretionary decision to have this data turned over. And then only lastly...
Hey, let me ask you something. I hope you can remember what you're about to say.
Sure.
If it were me, I wouldn't be able to remember, but I think you're younger than I am. Let me just ask something about that Directive 36. It's my understanding that that was offered to Mr. Gendusa, and then he didn't want to take it because he was concerned about the clawback provision. So do you want the Directive 36 information, or do you not want it?
We want the data to be disclosed under Directive 36 or as a matter of sustaining the circuit court's discretionary decision to have the data disclosed. Now, again, under Directive 36 even, I think indicated in the record with the motion to supplement that was filed, indicates that in our motion to supplement, indicating that we do not want, even as part of Directive 36, we have not requested the health information. On page 28 of that, the affidavit of Attorney White's indicating that we're looking again for names, birth dates, actuarial scores. Even under Directive 36, we have no contemplation of obtaining any HIPAA-protected information, though the approval was granted initially to turn over the entire data set.
So this will be my last question. All you are asking for are three things: names, dates of birth, and actuarial scores?
We've also asked, and Dr. Thornton testified at the hearing about why this would be important, is the essentially the answers to each of the questions underlying the Static 99 and Static 99R, which reflect, which would help reflect, I think, the predictive nature of all of those factors to the Wisconsin data set. So you could look at each one of those and get a slightly better idea. But really, it is, as indicated on page 28 of that motion to supplement, you know, the information reflected there are the items that we would be looking for. Again, nothing to do with substance abuse information, nothing to do with protected health information.
Why are we to think that the database is helpful to you? Perhaps you need information that is more particularized for your client. For example, should the data be turned over indicated what race each person in the database is, because perhaps different races have had different recidivism. Is that anything that you would be looking at?
It is not. No, there's nothing about race that would be relevant to the search for, or the DOC data set and the comparisons that we're looking to make here. There's nothing in the Static 99 itself that I think takes account of that I'm aware of. And so that would not be the sort of information that we would be seeking disclosure of.
Except I think you said the order is broader than that which you seek. And so again, the camel's nose analogy, are you agreeing that the order is overly broad?
The circuit court's order or the order from granting our request under Directive 36?
Either or both.
Okay. I think that the circuit court's order is broader than it needs to be, but nevertheless reflects the circuit court's, again, discretionary decision to have that information turned over. both because it is exculpatory and, as I believe Justice Hagedorn was discussing during Ms. Kumper's arguments, you know, that under 980.036 sub 5, you know, the court could decide to disclose that information and order the disclosure of the entire data set. Under Directive 36 as well, the initial approval does reflect a full approval for the research request that was submitted. And similarly, during follow-up emails between the Department of Corrections staff and Mr. Weitz, it was, you know, determined that there was this much narrower category of information that we actually required to get an accurate determination of Wisconsin rates of recidivism.
Except we're dealing with a circuit court order, and then the overlay of that with the language and statute, privacy concerns, HIPAA, existing Brady concerns. You think the existing circuit court order complies and satisfies each of those separate concerns? That might be why we considered something that's an interlocutory appeal. Those are pretty big issues.
Sure. I think that the circuit court's order still complies with all privacy-related statutes. And I suppose that was the third of my points, you know, that we have about this, that the circuit court did correctly order the disclosure of that information. And so while I suppose I make the offer of a stipulation by means of the respondent's desire to be agreeable, we're not trying to get data that we don't need. And so we are willing to, again, agree to the amendment of that order to reflect that fact. Nevertheless, I think that
what should our rule in this case be then, if we were to decide it? Is it because there's a stipulation now that's not reflected in the circuit court order and they really don't want everything the circuit court order allowed? It seems to satisfy these things enough, so to allow it here?
I think that the circuit or that this court could enter an order approving the disclosure of the data as requested of the Department of Corrections, as I've noted in the affidavit submitted by Attorney Weitz. Setting that aside, I think that this court alternatively can simply affirm the decision made by Judge Wall that this information should be disclosed. After having heard Dr. Tyer testify that, you know, his own preliminary review of this data showed that only 7% of these individuals were found to recidivate, that this is exculpatory, that it is showing a lower rate of recidivism than the samples that the state and its experts are going to try to use to compare with Gendusa. And so I think that that was, having, again, heard from Tyer, having heard what his information showed on a preliminary basis, you know, the circuit court acted within its discretion to have that turned over.
Help me understand on this HIPAA piece, why Directive 36 matters. I understand that, okay, maybe there's a legitimate research request, but I'm unclear as to how that would impact our analysis on the statutory slash discovery question that we have here. Those seem to be separate matters, related as a pragmatic matter, I get it, but I understand how that would affect our legal analysis on the scope of discovery or the legal questions regarding HIPAA.
I don't know that it relates to the parameters of discovery, the approval under Directive 36. I mean, I think that that the circuit court still acted properly, including that the evidence was exculpatory, and I believe that it should be disclosed under 980.036 sub 5, regardless of anything that happens with Directive 36. I think Directive 36 simply reflects that there is, in fact, no HIPAA violation in having the evidence turned over, that the data would be properly turned over under the rules of discovery, and that, you know, as the state is trying to negate, well, sure, setting aside the rules of discovery, you still can't turn it over because of HIPAA. Well, I think that the Directive 36 takes that argument off the table and reflects that, no, we've been approved to have the data, and so there is no HIPAA violation in having it disclosed.
I don't understand that. It seems to me that one could have a research request, and if the research request is approved, that's one method to lawfully gain access to the data. But that doesn't necessarily mean that another method of access to the data potentially doesn't violate it, because the authority for doing that is different, right? You have different statutes, you have different mechanisms for getting access to the data, each with their own requirements.
we requested the data for the exact same purpose under both, you know, Directive 36 and in requesting it via discovery.
One other follow-up. There is a, it seems to me that under HIPAA, and maybe I miss this, but there's a the Code of Federal Regulation 165.512 that seems to indicate that a covered entity may disclose protected health information in the course of any judicial or administrative proceeding in response to an order of the court, provided you only disclose the protected health information authorized by the order. Does that, are you familiar with that? Does that apply here in any way?
I apologize that I'm not. Based on your description of it, it sounds, you know, potentially applicable, that it reflects, you know, sort of a similar catch-all that, again, sub 5 in the 980 discovery statute covers, that, you know, essentially there's the willingness to recognize a circuit court's, you know, reasoned decision-making to allow for the disclosure of evidence that is not, you know, otherwise covered by any more specific provision, that it would seem that that would be discoverable or disclosable under HIPAA then.
Under part two, that analysis there, are you aware of any federal government support for the treatment programs under 980 in the record at all? It seems that there's, that that's a prerequisite to the part two argument under the law.
I'm sorry, perhaps I'm not quite understanding the question. I apologize.
I'm sorry. Part two seems to suggest that unless there's federal assistance given to a specific program, that it's confidentiality doesn't apply. So I guess I'm asking, are you aware of anything in the record suggesting the federal government is supporting those particular treatment programs under this?
There's nothing in the record reflecting any sort of federal support. You know, our brief focuses instead on some of the definitional problems with part two, that again, it is an individual, you know, seeking a service for some sort of alcohol or other abuse or other drug abuse treatment, and that there's no treatment being sought here. That again, this is entirely disconnected from the provision of mental health or physical health services, that, you know, creating this special purpose evaluation is again simply being done for purposes of determining whether a person should be committed or not, not again for providing these voluntarily sought after services.
Attorney Haskell, one of the things that we are being asked to look at in this case is whether or not Brady versus Maryland applies to Chapter 980 cases. And I'm interested to know from you why you think we should address that issue, given 980.0362J, which is the discovery part of the statute that says you must turn over exculpatory evidence, and then 980.036(9), which talks about the sanctions for failing to comply with the discovery statute. Isn't that the same protection or enough protection? Why should we analyze whether or not Brady applies to 980 cases?
I think that the existence of a statute requiring the disclosure of exculpatory evidence still doesn't really do anything to resolve whether Gendusa or those facing Chapter 980 prosecution have a constitutional right separately. I think that the two provisions could probably be construed, you know, very similarly. And the fact that the legislature has chosen to require disclosure of exculpatory evidence at this point is good and reflects the fact that we want to be cautious before indefinitely and involuntarily committing an individual under that statute. But nevertheless, there's nothing that necessarily ensures the continued existence of that statutory provision. And so it still remains important to define the constitutional rights that a respondent like Gendusa possesses in these types of cases. And we've got a case here where, again, we're well situated to decide the issue, in that we have
Brady is not a discovery case. Brady puts an affirmative obligation on the prosecutor, right?
Yes.
And if Brady were to apply here, we would be giving the prosecutor the obligation to search all the agencies of the state to see if there's anything that's exculpatory. So the defendant doesn't have to ask for it. Brady requires it when the prosecutor knows that there's exculpatory evidence. So it's a very different thing, I think, than the discovery statute that we're talking about, which does require disclosure of exculpatory evidence, but discovery is something that's usually generated when the defendant requests it. Am I missing something here? Or?
No, I mean, you're correct that Chapter 980 would require at least a demand for the evidence. Once that demand is made, you know, I think the obligations become similar on the prosecuting agency to disclose the evidence.
But Brady doesn't require a demand, right?
That's correct. Nevertheless, Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. If you want to add something, go ahead.
Oh, well, only as indicated in our briefs that I don't think that there's any real, risk that there's going to be, the prosecuting attorney having to scour the files of the state, of every state agency to try to find these things. Again, it is the Department of Corrections that refers these cases for commitment. It is entirely on Department of Corrections files that, that Dr. Tyer relied on in this case. So it is Department of Corrections files that are going to be looked at and Department of Health Services, where the respondent will wind up after, that referral for prosecution is made. And so I think it's much narrower where this information is going to be in the state's possession.
Counsel, can you address the orders aspect, which was sub three of Judge Wall's order, not only requiring the disclosure of this information, but also that Dr. Thornton analyzed the data on behalf of the respondent. Did the circuit court have the authority to do that?
I believe so. I believe that after Dr. Thornton had already been appointed as the defense's examiner in this case and had indicated through his testimony his willingness to examine the Department of Corrections data set, that it was proper for the circuit court to then go one step further and ask Dr. Thornton to then perform that study. I don't think there's anything in the order that prevents Dr. Thornton from seeking relief from the order if for some reason he concludes that he no longer wants to be a part of the study, if he does not want to participate anymore. Dr. Thornton remains free to seek that sort of relief so that there is no more order requiring him to do so. But as well indicated in our briefs, insofar as the court finds that order to be problematic, it can be amended to be, or the circuit court's order can be amended to remove that requirement as, again, Dr. Thornton has indicated his voluntary willingness to review this information. And so the existence of the order is really immaterial to the state's obligation to disclose it and our efforts to determine, again, an accurate rate of recidivism for Wisconsin offenders referred for a special purpose evaluation.
So has he agreed to review the data to study it and give you his opinion and testify?
Yes, it's not that he'll review the de-identified data is the intention that other individuals would establish those who've reoffended and those who have not, so that Dr. Thornton can then do the appropriate statistics to actually determine, rates of recidivism, again, specifically across static 99R scores and to determine, rates of recidivism for Wisconsin offenders.
So those rates have not yet been determined for this database that we're talking about?
Well, they have, and that's something that Dr. Tyer testified about, is that he's been involved in a separate research study with researchers from the Department of Health Services to examine this themselves, because this database is pretty plainly being compiled for purposes of just, data collection. Again, it's just a bunch of ones and zeros in a spreadsheet that a secretary enters from every special purpose evaluation. And he and his researchers have determined that only 7% out of the 913 that they were able to, examine, 913 offenders, went on to reoffend. And again, this is the best apples to apples comparison with Jendusit. These are individuals who were referred for a special purpose evaluation that was drafted by the Department of Corrections, just like the position Jendusit is in. And that only 7% have reoffended, again, is dramatically lower than the 19% base rate that Dr. Tyer was using for comparison with Jendusit. I mean, Dr. Tyer was compared.
Does he have the expertise, or has someone testified about the differences in the two databases? I know that some of the people in Razor and Static 99 are not Wisconsin citizens. But has there been any evaluation of why that should be a difference that matters, or the database that we have in Wisconsin is much, much smaller than has been used for these other studies?
It is smaller, but Dr. Thornton testified that this would be useful, as I've said, because it gives the best comparison to people like Jindusa, because those other Wisconsin offenders have similar treatment opportunities that Jindusa has had in prison, because he's been in the same prison system as those offenders. You know, any time that he spent on release have been subject to similar conditions of extended supervision. And so those similarities that those different inmates, face, put them in a position that make those the best to compare with. Dr. Thornton testified that the international sample used for this high-risk, high-needs group that he's using for comparison, at least the Danish sample, for example, was entirely a psychiatric population, and so involved those with, more acute psychiatric needs that don't always necessarily match up quite so well for use with data in Chapter 980 cases. And so this data really is a really, really good and reliable opportunity to get a Wisconsin rate of recidivism.
Counsel, I want to return to Brady. And it seems to me that perhaps addressing a Brady issue is a bit premature. Normally, we see Brady issues raised after conviction when a new trial is being sought for information that wasn't previously provided. Brady has a materiality component, and under our case law, that materiality component is equated with the second prong of Strickland, that is there prejudice? So it seems like maybe it's premature to be looking at whether or not Brady is implicated here because of the needed finding of really prejudice, which means the result would be different, if our cases are to stand equating those two.
I think that it would be premature for this court only to find that there's been a violation of Brady in this sort of case. Nevertheless, Brady sets forth the prosecutor's pretrial obligations to turn over evidence. And so this case, I think, remains a useful one to determine what those pretrial obligations are. Instead, I think we only run the risk that the court decides, we don't need to resolve the Brady issue and remands the case. And then Jindusa finds himself committed and seeks an appeal asserting Brady. And then the court has to find that there's a Brady violation. And then there's a second trial. I think that we're in a good position to be able to establish, again, what is exculpatory, that this evidence is exculpatory. As far as materiality, it is apparent, I think, from Dr. Tyer's testimony, again, about the low rates of recidivism from these Wisconsin offenders, that the evidence would be material at an eventual trial for Mr. Jindusa. It would be used not only because it would tend to show that he is not likely to reoffend individually, but that it could be used to impeach any state's experts that rely on, the Static 99, for example, as Dr. Tyer has testified, that, again, reliance on that that tool could become problematic if it turns out that Wisconsin offenders are really reoffending at much lower rates than the Static 99R is showing. And so we should be, again, focusing on the most reliable and the most comparable set of offenders in these types of cases.
How do we know this evidence is exculpatory or impeaching? How do we know that? I thought the doctor had to go in there and look at it.
Dr. Tyer has gone in there and looked at it. And I think that at the beginning of this case, Justice Hagedorn had quoted some comments from Judge Wall in the trial court indicating that it was a little speculative at the beginning of this case whether this information would wind up being exculpatory. But that speculation turned into fact when Dr. Tyer came in and testified that he had reviewed this information, that out of the 913 offenders that his research team had investigated, that only 7% had gone on to reoffend. This is decidedly lower than the you know, more likely than not to reoffend standard that the state has to meet. It is lower than every sample in the static 99R, lower than the high-risk, high-needs group that the state's expert has been using to justify a finding that Genduza meets the criteria for commitment. I mean, so this would be used to show, again, this 7% rate could be used to show not only that Mr. Genduza is not over 50% likely to reoffend, but that similarly, Dr. Tyre is relying on a problematic sample when he uses this high-risk, high-needs group of non-American offenders to assess Genduza's likelihood to reoffend.
Counsel, how do we know that the baseline relevancy of this data set, if it's as you represent, really applies and can be compared with, the say, the RAISR score, the static 99 score, because those before the score comes out, there are all different factors that are looked at. Each factor has some weight, and then the person under evaluation is compared with those that are similar in all of the factors. So the weights for him will be similar. It's a much more complicated thing than just saying, oh, well, this group is only a 7% of these people reoffended, where the score out of a static 99 is many times higher. I'm not sure that we're really comparing two things that are the same.
The base rate sets, again, sort of that baseline for determining the rate of reoffense for anyone in the group. I mean, within each score, there would then, yes, be different rates of recidivism. Right. But even setting that aside, I mean, one could look at the static 99R and look at that routine sample of all offenders and still find a rate of reoffense for all of them, regardless of score, is still higher than what the Wisconsin sample is showing. And what Dr. Tyre is trying to do is not only compare Genduza to that sample, but he's relying on a base rate that starts at that 19% of these offenders are reoffending. And it turns out that's not what Wisconsin offenders are doing. Wisconsin offenders are simply reoffending less than the international offenders that the state's experts are trying to use for comparison. And so that's the problem. And then within that, we can begin to examine for a particular score on the static 99R, you know, the narrower ranges, perhaps, of likelihood to reoffend. But this base rate itself, you know, reflects an overestimation by the state's expert. I think that, as well, I want to turn at least briefly here to the last point made in our brief, that I think this case should still be dismissed as improvidently granted in any effect. Precedent pretty firmly establishes, as Justice Bradley has noted, that this court will not review an order that is a discretionary decision from a non-final order. And so seeing my time's up, I will stop.
You can finish your thought. That's fine.
Thank you. Only that I think deciding this case opens the door for litigants who are already sufficiently dissatisfied with the outcome in the trial court that they've decided to seek an interlocutory appeal. You know, they're now being invited to seek this court's review, causing further delay to trial court litigants, to victims, to defendants in these cases, on top of the potential added time that it will take the Court of Appeals to deny these or to rule on these types of cases if we're going to be asking them to exercise their discretion and offer a reasoned explanation for every denial. And so for these reasons, I think this court should still just dismiss the cases improvidently granted. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honors. I have several points I'd like to make, but mainly I'd like to address what I think is a gross mischaracterization of what has been done with this information and what Tyre testified to at that November 9th hearing. This
Comfort,
data has
before,
not been answered.
Ms. Comfort, before you get to that,
love to hear that. That was my question that I was asking him. Would you mind if she just answered
no,
it?
No, of course not.
Okay, so here's the problem. I hear Mr. Genduza saying that this data has been analyzed by Dr. Tyre and it's showing a 7% recidivism rate, and that is simply false. If you go back and you look at that November 9th hearing, what Dr. Tyre said was, all we have done is taken a preliminary stab at starting to winnow out some of these offenders. So what they did was they took all of the people's names and they ran it through CCAP. And it turns out that 7% of those names came back with CCAP information. But Then if you go back and look at what Dr. Tyer testified to, he said that can't tell us anything because you have to still do further analysis to figure out what that means. And here's an example. They're saying that this shows a 7% reconviction rate, but we don't know anything about the kind of timeline that was involved there. So let's say that the 857 of these guys who haven't been reconvicted have only been out for 2 years. But then the 63% who have been reconvicted were all out for 10. What that means is that the actual recidivism rate would be 100%. And so that's what we're talking about when we're saying this information is not in the kind of is not in the kind of place where we can tell if it has any exculpatory value whatsoever, because it's simply a pile of numbers. It's not anything that shows anything yet, because it needs further analysis before it can actually have any meaning. And that's why I'm concerned about the defense hooking its hat on this. While Dr. Tyer analyzed it, he didn't. The court ordered him to open up this spreadsheet that he and his colleagues had not been able to take any further steps on, and he simply counted up the hits that came back. And he very specifically testified that that tells us nothing, because without further analysis of that data, we don't know what the actual rate is. And another thing I'd like to clarify is that...
Just 1 second to recover. Chief Justice Robinson, did that answer the question?
Yeah, it did. Thank you very much, Judge.
Yeah, of course. Let me ask you this. I understand your argument that there would need to be further analysis done on this data. But Attorney Haskell just, in an answer to a question that I asked him when I said, what are you looking for to be turned over? He said four things: name, date of birth, actuarial score, and the static 99 score. What of those four things is protected health information?
So under the federal regulations, all four of those things are protected health information. And if you look at CFR specifically, 45 CFR 164.502D2I, I know he described this as a bunch of ones and zeros, but that statute says that something that's got that encoded information that's provided with a code to decipher it is protected. And if you look at 45 CFR 160.103, this covers anything that is created by a provider and that relates to the past, present, or future mental health of the individual. And I simply don't see how you could possibly say that their score in this actuarial tool isn't related to the past, present, or future mental health of the individual. It's very clearly talking about what kind of disposition they've got to reoffend because of this mental illness. And further, that same subsection says that demographic information is considered protected health information as well. So I don't think there's really a meritorious argument to say that this isn't protected. But I think the more interesting part of what Attorney Haskell said was they don't care if they get this under Directive 36 or if they get it through the discovery provision, because their purpose is the same, and that's to conduct a research project on what the actual reoffense rate is.
And Ms. Comfort, let me ask you another question. Who's your client here? Is your client, I know you're an assistant attorney general, I know your client is the state, but are you representing the Department of Corrections? Are you representing the individuals whose protected healthcare information you're trying to protect? Are you representing the state in this case as it relates to Mr. Jandusa and the 980?
So I would say that who we're representing here, particularly DOJ as a whole, is we're representing the state of Wisconsin as a prosecutorial entity in a 980 case. And that's why we're saying, I think I've made it clear, we are not trying to prevent him from getting this through Executive Directive 36. That's the proper way to go. And if DOC wants to give it to him under that, we have no quarrel with that whatsoever. The problem is seeking this information as discovery. He simply picked the wrong avenue. And if he thinks that DOC has erroneously denied his request, then he needs to go through the administrative process in order to get that information, because he's admitted that he wants it to do a research project. And we have very specific statutes that say here's what you have to do, here's the protocol that you have to follow, and here's the kind of protections that we want to see in place for this kind of thing if you're going to use protected health information for research, especially this is protected health information without the consent or knowledge of any of these people. They don't know that this is being handed over to Dr. Thornton. And when you combine that with the fact that we've got very specific discovery statutes, we've got very specific provisions for what these what in the privacy law statutes for what kind of things are releasable, and it's all things that are related to the offender. I think when you look at the statutory scheme as a whole, they're trying to get this for a research purpose, and that's just fine. But there's a specific way that you have to go about it, and you can't just fling open the doors of discovery to do it that way. And there's a procedure for pursuing that, and that's the state of Wisconsin's position.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you both for participating in oral argument under our new procedures. You did a very good job, and it's very helpful to the court to have you here to answer our many questions. And your briefs were very helpful as well. Well, we are going to adjourn for this morning, and the court will reconvene in closed conference at 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.